Okay, so well, thanks, Katrina, for that amazing sound performance. And so now we're going to just have a kind of little chat about noise in its various noise, randomness, and chance, the way that that's working in various different domains of analysis, let's say. Did you want to start with something to Giuseppe? No? Okay, well, our plan is to kind of go through kind of how these terms relate to kind of biology, physics, and then up through cognition, yes, perception, and yeah, around to noise, to music in the end. So let's start by asking Giuseppe to tell us a little bit about kind of how the terms can be distinguished with regard to how they work in physics and biological systems.
Okay, well, I would love to talk first of your music, which I enjoy very much. We'll do that later on, okay?
Okay.
Because I understand there is a lot of intelligent structure there, which is very different from randomness. One thing should be clear is that randomness is not in nature. Randomness is an interface between us and nature. If you ask the dice, where will you go? The dice would say, I will go along a geodetic. The only possible one, the best possible trajectory, like a river. If you have a river in a very irregular landscape, beginning its path, you would ask the river, where will you go? The river would say, I will go along the best path to the sea, and you will not go wrong. Randomness pops out because if you try to make all the measurement possible to understand the trajectory of the dice and to predict it, approximation is sufficient so that the minor fluctuation, the frictions, will forbid you to make a prediction. And then, with respect to your best theory, you say, this event is totally unpredictable. I know the regularities. It is random. I can give some probabilities, as we have seen before, based on the symmetries of the die. However, you will not be able to predict the trajectory, that is, the final result. In quantum physics, it's slightly different. If you ask to a quantum, where would you go? The quantum would answer, well, it depends on the question you will ask me, when and where. At most, the answer would be the probability of a certain value of a given observable that you choose. So randomness pops out in the friction between our theoretical proposals, our measurement tools, and nature. And it is different in various areas. So if you start with quantum physics, I see there an image coming from a splitting of a photon, the probability there, in the dominating interpretation, which I like better, are given in an intrinsic way, in the sense there is no cause hidden behind the fact that the photon will go in a path or another. It is a pure contingency, like the spin up, spin down of an electron. In the dominating interpretation, which I think is the most reasonable, again, there are no hidden variables. It is unpredictable intrinsically. That's the intrinsic approach to randomness in quantum physics. This is very different from what you may have in classical domains. I would love to see the images of a hurricane or of bifurcation.
It's contingent.
Yeah, you see. Of course, you cannot predict the details of the form. This is a nonlinear dynamics, so the shape and the structure follow major regularities. Each line there, each surface is an optimal surface, fully determined, but highly unpredictable in all the details. However, and this is a crucial point with respect to biology, the phenomenon is necessary in the sense that under certain conditions of the parameters and the observables, you will have a hurricane. You will have a snowflake under certain temperature and condition of humidity. However, you will not be able to predict exact symmetries of a snowflake. In mathematics, this engendered a beautiful area, an analysis of bifurcations and homoclinic trajectories that I would love to see on the screen, where the bifurcation shows mathematically the non-analyticity of a trajectory. This means that at bifurcation point, a minor fluctuation below your best measure will send this, the flying body or whatever it is in one direction or another. Bifurcation are a typical case of classical impredictability of a fully deterministic structure. In the next slide, we could see that the algebra is very easy. Now, that's another case of also chaotic nonlinear dynamics. Yeah, okay, here you see, the algebra is very easy. This is totally deterministic in the sense that probably the person in charge of the projection is not totally deterministic.
Coming up to kind of biological systems, right? So in the case of this non-deterministic projector handler, then there's something.
Okay, but let me finish.
Oh, go on. Okay.
The equation is very simple and it's totally deterministic. The equation determines the trajectory. However, there are plenty of bifurcations, which gives a very complex geometry. That's a typical nonlinear structure, like the nonlinearity of these enemies of our understanding. Now, let's move to biology. We already heard some remarkable aspect of in the beginning of this evening presentation about the intrinsic unpredictability of historical phenomena. And biology is essentially an historical science. You can't understand anything if not in the light of evolution. What it means to be historical is that you cannot give probabilities in the sense there is no way to give a priori the space of possibilities. As it was said before, you must have the six possibilities of a die, of falling dice, to express the probabilities. And that's common in classical and quantum frame. You give a priori the space of possibilities, and then you can accord probabilities to randomness. Probability is not randomness. It's just a measure of randomness. Now, what happens in biology is that you don't know which will be the observables in the future. If you were 250 million years ago, you couldn't imagine that the double jaw or some mesostomes, I mean, some big vertebrates of the time, would originate in the internal ear, beginning a radically new observable, which is audition, which did not exist before. It is so in all historical science, where the change of the observables is what really scans time, together with rare events. Any phylogenetic trajectory is produced by the formation of a hopeful monster, something which is different from the average, say, of a population, of a species, and produces a novelty that, which is rare, and it's even more rare that the awful monster survives and originates speciation.
Can I just interrupt for a second?
Yes.
When you're talking about the historicism of biology, you're speaking about it in such a way that there's always this differentiation between the observation of one state and another state. So it seems like if we were to look at this in terms of, in very simplistic terms of a single timeline, we have various different windows cutting into points of observation. Doesn't that pose a problem to really understand the dynamics of what is driving these changes? Don't we need to kind of embody at some point the spaces in between these windows of observation?
The point is that in biology there are so many levels of organizations that interact. There are beautiful remarks by Darwin who really understood the key point in evolution, namely his first principle, spanning four chapters out of the first six. Any reproduction is with variation. That's his fundamental principle. And this, he didn't know to what it is this is due. And it is due to lots of factors. Of course, the molecular level, DNA, proteome, interaction of a cell with the organism, of the organism with the ecosystem. Each of them deserves a proper theory and produces its proper form of randomness. Because I said before, the notion of randomness is relative to the intended theory. And in biology, so many theories superpose because there are quantum effects at the molecular level, classical dynamics, there is a lot of water, there is hydrodynamics, there are cell-to-cell interaction, organism, ecosystem. Yes, in time, but this time is scanned in contrast to physical time, again, by the changes of the observable, and where prediction is impossible.
Right. So, and this is where this is something you kind of touched on in your talk on the first day when you're talking about kind of randomness in biological systems, and then you shifted to kind of randomness in economic systems, right? And in some case, the way you've described it is in terms of phase space dynamics. So in physics, we can construct the phase space of a system, and that's like that gives us the possible ways in which the system can be found, right? But the real distinction when you come to biological systems is that we can't possibly list all of those possibilities, because the system is you've described it as a cascade of symmetry breaking transitions, where the phase space is continually changing. And in social systems, you get that even more so, right?
Yeah. Would we have a different qualifying term for probability for these different scales of analysis?
Well, as long as probability is a measure, it requires a pre-given space. In each physical theory, there may be a different phase space, space of observables and parameters. In quantum mechanics, there is a very general one, which may even have infinite dimensions. But because of the symmetries there, you can describe it in finitely many words, and it's pre-given. Then you evaluate probabilities. Indeed, the dynamics of a quantum is the dynamics of a low probability. So that's totally treated in these very rigorous terms. The challenge in historical systems is the lack of this. I can tell you a little story. It is well known that Marconi used as the first antenna of his radio transmission a metal screwdriver that he had inherited from his grandfather. That screwdriver was produced in 1820, probably, and we are in 1900. So how could you, in 1820, accord any probability that the phenotype of the screwdriver would be such and such? Mm. There was not yet the pertinent observable.
Yeah.
We would call that a skeuomorph in archaeology. Not a phenotype.
Okay. I mean, I think though this is a good point to seg on to kind of the question of perception, right? Because I think Bernard earlier talked about the predictive processing framework, which is this new turn in cognitive science, which is based on this kind of Bayesian kind of inductive analysis of where it's often called the Bayesian brain hypothesis. So the idea is the cognitive architecture is a top-down system of predictions with a bottom-up error signal coming up, right? And I think this is probably the best kind of description that we've got of cognition at the moment. But it's not adequate to a full description of what a sapient cognition is. Mm-hmm. And I think that this relates to what you're talking about with this kind of constant changing of the probability space in which you're moving, right? So you can't reduce perception to the calculation of probabilities, because that assumes a given phase space, right?
Right. I mean, I think there's excellent mathematics there, but these people are confusing meteorological forecast, which is a remarkable science, with the imagination of configuration of sense, which is our permanent activity. Think of the human communicating community maybe 100,000 years ago inventing language together, which means talking of things that do not exist. Probably our ancestors at a certain moment started interpolating the stars and giving name. Oh, look, there is a lion, there is a bull there, probably also for practical reasons, but this was a myth, there was the invention of something which is not there. Why? In order to give meaning of something which is totally lack of sense, which is the little lights in the sky. We have been interpolating them and giving meaning to them, imagining a configurational sense. This is not weather forecast. This is the construction of meaning in human being together in language, acting in an ecosystem. That's at the core of human activity. This goes together. If you look at Lascaux, Altamura, these caves, these drawings, there are not only spots, there's a bison, a horse as a spot, but some of them, it's just a line. if you remember them, too bad I don't have the image here, but some of them, it's just a beautiful line of a bison or of a horse. And this is something, really, a step that humans made in language, telling each other together. No animal could recognize a lion from a border like that. And from there, we went to the invention of geometry with Euclid, where the fundamental structure he invents is the line with no thickness, which is the main and the primary structure of mathematics. Where is the line of no thickness? I mean, it's not the result of weather forecast. It's a gesture that extracts meaning to make something very useful, which is a theory of surfaces. Because you see, if you have a thickness and you're measuring a surface, if you, the border has a thickness, which is the surface, so they invented the notion of border, which is the origin of geometry and is the beginning of Western mathematics, only Western.
Then I think, you know, this is, if we're discussing kind of the origins of visual art, that we can kind of move to some extent to thinking about kind of how, you know, we've explored kind of auditory perception through our history, right? And this is something I think, you know, obviously in the, you know.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about this imaginary line, because as I understand it, what you're implying is that there's a signification process that happened in the articulation of this line, which in some sense, I've heard you speak about this before, this implies a kind of gesture of rationality, that you're able to make sense of one point to another, because a line isn't just a line, it also signifies connection, right? And in this sense, I was wondering how, if you are to imagine the line extending beyond the point at which you stopped articulating it, this infinite possibility of extending outward in whatever direction implies also dimensionality. So there seems to be a kind of a construction process. You have like the building blocks of mathematics with this single line producing the connection. In terms of auditory perception, which if we can go back to talking about face space again, mm-hmm. implies that there are transformations taking place from one sound object becoming another. Whether the source is the same or not, it depends on how we identify the source. So finding, reproducing this continuity in our minds between the start of a sound to the end of a sound, and how that transformation has undergone a process from something similar to something different. How can we then understand the role that memory and forgetting play in these dynamics of abstraction?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a key point about memory. Because, I mean, human animal memory has nothing to do with the memory, I mean, the storage here, because the fundamental quality is forgetting. Namely, an animal, in order to precede a prey, has to imagine and see a trajectory and precede it. So by experience, like a little child who needs several months to get the ball, because it has to precede it in order. The pretensive gesture can only be constructed if you have an experience of trajectories and you forget what is useless.
Yes.
You have to forget the color of the ball. You have to forget the details of the forest in order to capture prey in another context. So forgetting the context, retention is forgetful. And when by the pretensive gesture we use memory, we use it in a contextual, we extract what we need by forgetting what is not there.
Okay, yeah, but this is also kind of, you know, fully explainable within this predictive processing paradigm, right? I think, you know, so you
forgetting?
Know, well, what you've just described, I mean, I think, you know, but I think, you know, at least we can
is
give
that
a description
monster?
Of this within the predictive processing. So, well, the whole idea would be based on the kind of idea of a lossy compression, right? So, and what so the relevant details are kept and the irrelevant details are lost.
The right? Point is to decide what's relevant or
exactly
not.
And I think this is where kind of you know you really can't describe kind of the kind of thinking that we do as just a kind of lossy source compression, right? Because the way in which we're kind of navigating what is relevant and irrelevant is according to kind of logical conceptual kind of normative linguistic kind of ideas, right? And I think that doesn't really fit in the kind of information theoretic understanding of compression.
Of course, I mean, as I said before, interpolating star is not elaboration information. We should not confuse elaboration of information, a remarkable science, with imagining configuration of sense. That's what we do all the time, by attributing contextually sense according to emotion. If there is a continuity with animal language, is the expression of emotions, it's the expression of fear. And from there, we went to invent a language to talk of things that do not exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, we invented language to talk of ancestors, of gods, which are not there, of constellations, as I said before, up to the line with no thickness, which does not exist. And this is so contingent that the Chinese did not do it. I mean, in the 3rd century after Christ, Louis is a remarkable mathematician. He has 9 books translated by my colleague Karim Shellah. And in these books, he has lots of theorems like Euclid, very different style. But when he computes pi, I mean, the approximation of the circle, and also for the diagonal square root of 2, he says, well, you make the approximation when you see that there is no more difference between the inscribed polygons and the circle, you stop computing. His line is not without thickness. It's according to convenience. If it is larger, you compute a little more. They don't go to infinity. They don't. They have beautiful mathematics, but they didn't meet this step, which related to the Platonic idea, that culture that had the Greeks for the limit construction, the Zeno paradox, and so on. We only had it is a contingent history. And then we went further in different ways, and the Chinese developed other techniques, a lot of algorithms that we needed the Arabs to invent them. So this the historical contingency based on frictions, on a variety of practical and conceptual experiences, which is the result, which gives as a result human cognition.
I actually had not in the same words that you put it, but I had a similar thing to say, was the importance of orientation and contingency, that when you decide that something is relevant, when you're able to form your own constraints, that is a matter of contingency, which requires a collective mind, in a sense. I mean, you cannot do this on your own. Of course, you can form your own boundaries, but through language, we develop ideas collectively. So in order to define these borders and to, boost our rational agency in order to actively engage with these parameters, that requires a collective mind.
Totally, yeah, and I think, I think this is kind of relevant to kind of, so the question of, sonic composition, right? So, we can think of it, perhaps in some ways similar to kind of scientific investigations, right? Scientific methodology, where you hypothesis generation and testing, but then there's also kind of contingent elements which are going to be kind of followed up on and so on. How do you kind of, and I guess, basically, well, the 20th century has massively expanded that space of sonic compositional possibilities, right? To include a lot of randomness and noise. And that's something I think you were exploring in your piece today. How do you navigate those constraints and the use of randomness in your composition?
Well, to be honest, I'm a diehard improviser. Mm-hmm. So I sort of rely on intuitive techniques that I've probably been nurturing since a young child, because I used to play classical piano as a child and also improvise on the piano. And that gave me a lot of tools for expressing emotions, for expressing ideas, imaginary fictions that I might attribute to certain kinds of sounds. I could do that through music, and it would just come. So it's not something that would be forced. However, of course, now I'm working with the computer, and when you do algorithmic composition, you can employ various techniques that allow you to predetermine, in a sense, your parameter space, play within that parameter space, but the results you get are not necessarily anything you would expect. So it's a different orientation to randomness. For instance, the piece that you heard tonight, the latter part, was all based on a single recording of my voice. So from the moment you heard the voice, everything from that point on was based on one source file. But you can produce many different variations of sounds from that one file. And what's amazing about the voice is that the voice has all these artifacts of noise. So there's no repetition in any wave sets of a waveform with voice. And because of that, you can, when you multiply the wave sets, which is what I was doing for this piece, using an algorithmic toolbox, which was developed by Trevor Wishart, which I know that we've talked about his work before. Mm-hmm. He developed a piece of software with a group of UK composers based in York, and it was the first complex sound transformation toolkit developed before people had personal computers. So the whole idea of developing this system was to make these experimentations with parameters to listen back and discover what you heard after making the transformations. So that's a completely different technique. And we can, in some sense, try to predetermine what we will have as results, but it, because of the voice in this case, the irregularities within the waveform itself in these particular transformations that I was doing, that's based on time amplitude not working with the spectral right. range. So. You can produce all kinds of interesting results that are quite alienating because it's not something you might have heard before. Mm.
So in some sense, you're kind of following in the tradition of music concrète, right? Which is kind of taking a sample and then kind of manipulating it in various ways. So kind of walking around it, bending it topologically and so on.
Yeah.
But then also you're using synthesis as well, which was kind of traditionally opposed to those methods, right?
Yeah. Well, the thing, I guess, with that would differ would be that with a lot of musique concrète, what you have, what you hear often is still somehow recognizable. Mm. And I'm really interested in getting to this point of not being able to delineate, a kind of... equivalent in terms of what you're hearing in an object in the real world. So really playing with these levels of abstraction in order to deterritorialize your sense of belonging to what you are producing or what you're hearing. Mm.
Okay, we're getting called to finish, I think. So I think we'll have to stop our conversation here. Thank you.
Thank you.